Blackstone Audio presents V for Vendetta, novelization by Steve Moore, based on the graphic novel, illustrated by David Lloyd, and published by Vertigo DC Comics, based on the screenplay written by the Wachowski brothers. Remember, remember, the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. 1. A strange, shadowy room, somewhere deep beneath the streets of London. Of old, old London, that had seen so much in 2,000 years of war and terror and despair. Founded by the conquering legions of Imperial Rome, and within 20 years reduced to ash by raging Boadicea, who in her fury killed 80,000 of her own countrymen and hardly touched the Roman lords at all. Abandoned to the Saxons, decimated by the Black Death, erased once more in the Great Fire, shattered yet again by Hermann Göring's Luftwaffe. Always falling, rising up, then falling still again, fallen now once more, and yet to foes more strange than plague, or fire, or war. For London, now, most famous city in the world, had fallen to its own. Yet in that strange and shadowy room a tall and equally shadowy figure moved with a slow and confident step, dressed in a long Puritan tunic of deep, undecorated black. Almost without thought, he flicked on a television set as he passed, then instantly turned his back. After all, he knew exactly what would be broadcasting at that time, and when the show was called The Voice of London, it hardly needed to be watched at all. But then, anyone looking round the man's home might wonder why he would be interested in such a program anyway. The room itself was but one of a number of interconnected chambers, their stone walls windowless, and each surmounted by a vaulted roof that gave the place an ancient, medieval look, like the crypt of some vast church or cathedral, or perhaps the wine cellar of some Renaissance millionaire. But no hallowed bodies were interred here, no barrels or bottles either. Rather, there were treasures of another sort, books, paintings, sculptures and various other artworks, some specially displayed and picked out by subdued lights that made them glow like gilded icons amidst their dark surroundings, yet did nothing to dispel the air of mysterious and all-pervading gloom. Others were merely stacked to take up as little room as possible, held in storage against a future time when they could be properly exhibited, or restored to their original homes. A vast collection of rescued objets d'art, of literary flights of fancy, of histories, and anecdotes, and thoughts, rescued from oblivion, from destruction, from vandals, and, most of all, from the government. Passing by a bookcase packed with curious political visions, from Thomas More's Utopia and Campanella's City of the Sun, through Karl Marx's Das Kapital to Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, some banned now and some required reading, the man made his way toward a dressing table, settling himself before a large mirror surrounded with little electric bulbs, brought here from some theatre changing room. A relic of the times when theatres still showed plays, not mere burlesques or propagandist farces. And as the canned audience applause track died on The Voice of London, the introductions over, he pulled on black, close-fitting leather gloves. Then, as the deep, plummy, oh-so-English voice of Lewis Prothero, the show's host and eponymous Voice of London, not because he was, but because someone too high up to argue with had said that this was so, bade his audience welcome to the evening's programme, those same gloved hands reached out and switched on the make-up mirror's lights. As the feeble radiance spread out into the shadowed room, it showed a wall behind the dresser, plastered over with ancient movie posters from back before the Second World War. For this underground gallery gathered more than the art that most would call eternal. Here, too, were the artifacts and ephemera of popular culture, of television shows long vanished from the screen, of games that none had played for years, of songs no longer sung. And as the light flickered, the power supply being nothing like the way it used to be, the man's eyes lit upon Bela Lugosi, in Son of Frankenstein, and a faint, ironic smile quirked his lips as Prothero started to speak.
"I say," began the voice of London, "I read today that the formerly United States are so desperate for medical supplies that they've allegedly sent us several containers filled with wheat and tobacco, a gesture, they say, of goodwill."
The light came up a little then, revealing a shoulder-length black wig upon its own head-shaped stand, and with it a mask. As the gloved hands reached toward the latter, Lewis Prothero asked,
"Would you like to know what I think?"
Was that the slightest shake of the head as the mask was raised toward the man's face? Hardly worth asking, perhaps, for once the mask was strapped in place, all trace of its owner's expression, of his thoughts and very feelings, disappeared. And all that remained was that of the mask. For to wear a mask is to give up who we really are, and to become, perhaps for just a little while, perhaps for rather longer, that persona that the mask itself appears to represent. The mask. The masquerade. Almost white, this mask, with something of a debonair and harlequin look, the cheeks a little rouged, the lower lip a little pink, the eyes a little more than slits that seemed to smile at times, at other times to squint, yet always having something of the vulpine. The ebony-painted goatee, the inky black mustachios, forever curling upward at the ends, the smile forever fixed. Beguiling, bedeviling, a Guy Fawkes mask.
"Would you like to know what I think?" Lewis Prothero was asking on another television screen,
in a room about as high above the ground as the previous one was far below. A far more poorly decorated room this, the rent alone consuming too much of the occupant's monthly paycheck to allow for fripperies or frills, in a run-down back street not far from Paddington Station. Here, too, a figure sat before a mirror, putting on disguise. Not a mask this time, but the disguise that women wear, of lipstick, eyeshadow, powder and mascara, that says, "My eyes are dark with mystery, my lips are red with passion, my skin is young and smooth." Not that there was anything about this particular woman that needed such disguise. And frankly, there was something about Gordon Dietrich, the prospective target of these wiles, that made Evie Hammond wonder why she was bothering in the first place. But she knew the answer to that question anyway. If she wanted to get on and up that damnable career ladder, this could be the most important date in her life. That was the way things worked these days. So gild the lily, then, and take whatever's offered. Besides, more money and better career prospects might enable her to get a place in one of those new condominiums they were building, safe behind their own security fences, entrances protected by their own armed guards, where, even if the food and fuel and other necessities of life were still to be had only with the appropriate ration coupons, at least one could live with a little less fear. And Evie Hammond so very much wished to live without the fear that haunted all her days, and more. And worse, her dreams.
"You're watching my show," the voice of London continued,
though Evie was really doing this no more than a certain other of the program's audience not so very far away.
"So I'll assume you do. I think it's high time we let the colonies know what we really think of them. I think it's high time we paid them back for a little tea party they threw for us a few hundred years ago."
With an apparent mastery of the dramatic pause, Prothero stopped while the technicians cranked up the canned applause once more. Her makeup finished, Evie slipped into her best dress and smoothed it over her hips as she checked herself in the mirror. Full lips, high forehead, brown eyes, and straightish golden hair that fell and spread across her shoulders, a lithe figure that filled out in just the right places. Yes. She liked the way she looked, and if Dietrich didn't—well, actually, if he didn't, what did it really matter? Either she'd get in his good books, which might eventually lead to a promotion, or she'd just stay where she was and carry on the same as usual until another opportunity came up. And if the worst came to the worst, she could always try to find another job. There were plenty around these days. Or, more to the point, there were far fewer people around than there used to be to fill the same number of vacancies. People of a certain type. Actually, she thought, biting her lip nervously, a promotion would mean quite a lot. For the way the party organized things these days, promotions brought more status as well as money, and that would mean more food coupons for a start.
"What I say," Prothero's voice came again, when the applause had died down, "is that we go down to the docks tonight and dump that colonial crap where everything from the ulcered sphincter of Asserica belongs."
A pause. But this time not long enough for the applause to start again.
"Who's with me?"
Then a further silence, until the dramatic tension seemed almost unbearable. Finally, in his best rabble-rousing voice,
"Who's bloody well with me?"
And only then did the applause crash in, as the entirely fictitious audience went wild with apparently hysterical approbation. Evie shrugged. She knew the show like the back of her hand, after all, with all its tricks, all its prompts. She even knew who wrote Prothero's stuff and wrote his ad-libs, too. And heaven knows she knew the message it was trying to get across. What she didn't know was why anyone swallowed it. But they did. They did. And they had done so for more than 10 years now. And it looked as if they always would. Of course, no one was really going to dump wheat and tobacco in the docks. They might make a show of it for the cameras, throwing a few empty boxes into the water, but the wheat and tobacco would simply be spirited away to feed and soothe the party elite. If there was ever any there at all, that was. And the whole thing wasn't just another propaganda fraud to prop up British notions of superiority. These days, she knew, as an insider working at Jordan Tower, you couldn't believe anything the government said, apart from death threats and prohibitions. The applause storm having died down once more, Lewis Prothero continued in a much calmer, more intimate voice, a lighter, knowing voice that suggested sharing a joke with his viewers, and a common point of view.
"Did you like that? USA? The ulcered sphincter of Asserica? I mean, honestly, what else can you say? There was a country that had everything, and now, 20 years later, is what? The world's biggest leper colony. Why?"
Now the voice gained in confidence once again, became more emphatic, began to sound hectoring, demagogic, and loud.
"Godlessness. Let me say that again. Godlessness. It wasn't the war they started. It wasn't the plague they created. It was judgment."
More applause, while Evie could only think about how perceptions changed. When she was a little girl, after all, the USA had been regarded as one of the most Christian countries in the world, with right-wing Christian Republicans governing the place for year after year, with American Protestant missionaries taking their unwanted Bibles to all the other parts of the happily unredeemed world. And then there'd been the war. After that, the only things anyone remembered about the old America were its militarism and its conspicuous consumption, and what had been the promised land became nothing more than Rome and Babylon. And now no one cared about the state of the American soul, not here in England anyway, because now it was England that God smiled upon, and nowhere else at all. By then Prothero was really beginning to get into his stride.
"No one escapes their past. No one escapes judgment. You think he is not up there? You think he is not watching over this country? How else can you explain it? He tested us. But we came through."
Her expression souring by the moment, Evie clipped on her earrings and began brushing out her hair. She knew perfectly well what was coming next, and Prothero delivered exactly what she expected. The building rant, the reddening face that went with the words, the rising blood pressure, and eventually the shouting.
"We did what we had to! Islington, Enfield, I was there! I saw it all! Immigrants, Muslims, homosexuals, terrorists, disease-ridden degenerates, they had to go!"
And now the punchline, same as ever.
"Strength through unity! Unity through faith! I am a God-fearing Englishman, and I am God-damned proud of it!"
"And that's quite enough of that, thank you very much," said Evie, twisting round to turn off the television, just as Prothero began to give the God-damned salute. And then she turned back to the mirror to check her appearance one more time. Yes, she did look good, and she knew it, no matter what that nervy little voice in the back of her head might say. But perhaps just one last look in the mirror. The mirror with the photos tucked all round the frame. Her friends, her workmates, her parents. And it was that last one that always brought the same old lump to her throat. And on a night like this, perhaps that wasn't one to linger over. "Listen," she said, though whether to herself or to the photos, or to the empty air, she really didn't know. "He's a very nice man. He makes me laugh. But I'm just going to be honest with him, and if that costs me a job, well, that'll suck. But I've dealt with worse, haven't I? A lot worse." And then her eye lit once again on the picture of Mum and Dad, and she had to look away. And as she did so, her glance took in the clock. It said 1 minute after 11 o'clock.
"Oh, shit!"
exclaimed Evie, with sudden desperation, with sudden fear. And with that she grabbed a small piece of paper with an address scribbled on it from the mirror frame and dashed toward the door, and out into a night more dark than any she had ever known. Underground. Back in that room of shadows and illusions, of literary dreams and cinematic fantasies, the dark-dressed man had by now completed his theatrical attire. The mask strapped on, the wig in place, long and soft black leather boots upon his feet that ran up above his knees, an inky cloak about his shoulders, and on his head a tall and tapering Jacobean hat, its round brim wide enough to add another layer of mysterious shadow to his already enigmatic, grinning features. Something of the dandy, something of the scarecrow, something of the knight. Checking his appearance one last time in the mirror, he turned off the dressing-table lights and turned toward a nearby bust of Shakespeare. Then, striking a pose, he began to declaim in a rolling, oratorical tone to his audience of solitary stone,
"Nor Mars his sword, nor war's quick fire, shall burn the living record of your memory."
A bow, a swirl of the cloak, and then, in a much lighter, more mischievous voice,
"Don't wait up for me, Will. I intend to enjoy myself tonight."
And with that he was gone, and the lights were extinguished, and all that then remained were galleries of shadow. 2. All her nerves jangling like overstretched violin strings being pizzicato plucked by a demented Paganini, Evie Hammond made her way with desperate haste along the ill-lit streets, heels clicking a percussive accompaniment on the concrete paving slabs. Above her head, a passing swath of heavy cloud had smothered up the moon and stars, and settled like a blanket on the eerily quiet streets, adding darkness to darkness, silence to silence. No cars drove here. No omnibuses passed, their cargoes of late-night revellers long since delivered home. Not that anyone revelled much these days anyway, except perhaps the upper echelons of the elite. But who was she to really know anything about what they did, whatever she might have been conjecturing earlier about wheat and tobacco? After all, the scandalous stories she heard around the office were probably nothing more than that. Stories. The party was building the New Jerusalem here, not the New Babylon. Though where she was now, heading toward Googe Street, seemed far from either. Here there was only silence and empty streets and the clicking of her heels, grown now to almost thunder-cracking loudness in her oversensitive ear, and the omnipresent surveillance cameras, all labelled "For Your Protection," but to her, at this time of night, the greatest threat of all. If only she hadn't left it so late! Hurry on. It wasn't far to Gordon Dietrich's home in Bloomsbury now, and light and music, good company and wine and warmth, and safety. Whatever reservations she might have had about seeing him before had completely disappeared. All she wanted was to be there in his house, even in his arms if necessary, so long as she could stay there until the morning light, when everything would be back to normal and she could pick up the usual course of her life once more. Because right now, frankly, she was scared out of her wits. Not far. If only these back roads north of Oxford Street weren't so dank and ill-lit. But then she didn't dare use the main streets at this time of night, where her presence would be far too obvious. Hurry on. Through the litter that kept building up, because proper English people considered it beneath their dignity to clear up these days, and they'd got rid of all the other people. Past the tattered flags and placards left over from one of those party rallies held a few days before, which only reminded her of the authorities and how they handled breaches of the law. Faster. If only she put on her other shoes, she could surely have walked more quickly than in these. But no, she'd had to dress for looks rather than comfort. And running in these was quite out of the question. Hurry, hurry, and stop. Was that someone there ahead of her, a little farther up the street? Or just a trick of the light, a moving shadow caused by a breeze-blown piece of litter? But there shouldn't be anyone here. She shouldn't be here. In a sudden, panicked fluster, Evie turned aside and made her way into a shadowy, cobbled alley, and began to hurry once again. The alley didn't look at all inviting, littered with trash cans and garbage as it was, but if she could just avoid that mystery figure, go round and find another alley that would lead her back to the same street beyond the place he lurked, if he was still lurking there. If he wasn't following her. If he wasn't just about to grab her. Run. Bad shoes and lack of breath or not, just run and glance back. No one there. But run, anyway. And run smack into something right in front of her while she was still looking back behind, something firm but yielding, soft on the outside but hard within. Her head spinning and her body reeling, her eyes lit on a poster pasted on the alley wall in the light of a small lamp. One of those posters that were everywhere, saying the same old thing, strength through unity, unity through faith, with a little angel-winged cross beneath it. The slogan that welded the nation together, kept everyone in line, ensured that no one went astray. And then there were strong arms uniting round her waist, supporting her, stopping her fall. But whether there was anything of faith about the big man in the tweed coat that she'd run into was very much an open question. As for angel wings, definitely not.
"Whoa!" he exclaimed in one of those theatrical catchphrase voices. "And excuse me, miss!"
Regaining her physical equilibrium, though still far too flustered to think straight, Evie stammered out, "I'm sorry, I didn't see you."
"In a hurry, are we?"
the man said, in an exaggeratedly calming voice, though his attempt at an avuncular smile somehow kept slipping to a smirk. Evie tried to step back, but his big hands were still there on her waist, and she knew exactly why he wasn't taking them away. Big, powerful hands to go with a muscular, big-boned body and a hardened, worldly face. A smugly evil glint lit up the man's otherwise cold and brooding eyes, eyes that said, "My lucky night here caught myself a babe."
"I was just—"
the man in the tweed coat interrupted, and now his voice was flat and cold. A statement, not to be argued with.
"After curfew, you know."
"My uncle—" said Evie, trying desperately to think of some sort of explanation as the alley seemed to grow darker and more threatening around her with every passing second. "He's very sick."
"Oh, a sick uncle, is it?"
Tweedcoat grinned, almost as if he hadn't heard that one before, releasing her waist now and running a lock of her long blonde hair through his calloused fingers as he turned to address a newcomer emerging from the shadows.
"What do you think of that, Willie?"
"Load of bullocks is what I think,"
said Willie, coming up behind her. Another powerful man, and no more pleasant-looking than his companion. Worse, in fact, for this one had an unpleasant scar across his forehead that even a flopping lock of hair did nothing to disguise. All the alarms were going off in Evie's head by now. Two bulky, threatening men, a gloomy back alley, no one anywhere nearby to appeal to, or even to hear her screams. Trouble. Big trouble. She glanced round, looking for a way out, tried to step back, but she was between the two of them now, and the alley was narrow enough for them to easily block her escape. Slowly she started to slip a hand into her pocket, hoping they wouldn't notice.
"I made a mistake," she said,
a little calmer now, and determined to try to talk her way out of this, if she possibly could, before she had to try something more desperate.
"I shouldn't be out after curfew. I know that. But my uncle—"
"Well, maybe you could take care of us before getting back to your uncle," said Tweedcoat, grinning wolfishly, all pretense disappearing now. "See, my friend here, he's kind of sick." An evil laugh. "Ain't you, Willie?"
"Oh, yeah,"
sniggered Willie, reaching out to grab her free hand roughly.
"Real sick. Bad case of the blues it is. Here, you can feel 'em."
With that, he thrust his crotch forward and tried to press her hand between his legs, hardly able to suppress his mirth, but with a sudden panic strength, Evie managed to pull away, and with her other hand she pulled out the canister of pepper spray she'd had concealed in her pocket all this time.
"Don't touch me,"
she grated, as coldly and as threateningly as she could, brandishing the spray in front of her, backing up against the alley wall.
"Oh, look at that, Willie,"
guffered Tweedcoat, hardly impressed by her show of determination.
"Kitty's got claws."
A gap-toothed smile broke out on Willie's lips as he sidled up beside his companion to face her.
"She just threatened us," he remarked black-heartedly.
Somehow, then, he seemed to Evie as evil and villainous a bastard as she'd ever seen. As bad, or worse, than the ones who'd come in the night. That terrible night, so many years ago.
"That she did," Tweedcoat smirked back at him. "That she did. That's a Class G offence, ain't it?" "You know what that means?"
he asked, turning back toward Evie and suddenly pulling out a badge.
"It means that we get to exercise our own judicial discretion."
"And you get to swallow it,"
concluded Willie, chuckling lewdly.
"Oh, God, your fingermen,"
said Evie, final realization suddenly dawning. "The same ones."
"She's getting the picture,"
Tweedcoat winked at Willie.
"Oh, no, please,"
Evie began desperately, fear making her knees suddenly weak.
"I didn't know. I'm sorry."
"Not yet, you're not,"
Willie told her with a cold laugh and a glint in his eye of pure sadistic lust.
"But you will be," said Tweedcoat casually,
even though he seemed suddenly uninterested in making any attempt to restrain her, as she started to slide along the wall, hoping to make a last break for the end of the alley.
"If you're not the sorriest piece of arse in all of London by the time the sun comes up, you'll certainly be the sorest."
And still he stood there, doing nothing except turning knowingly toward Willie as they spread themselves across the alley, blocking off one direction completely. And as they glanced round for another exchange of winks, Evie was off and running the other way, terrified, desperate, unseeing once again, and running straight into a third finger man, whom the other two had obviously been aware of all the time, coming up behind her. This one even bigger than his companions, like running into a brick shithouse, as Gordon Dietrich would say in one of his cruder moments. The impact knocked all the breath out of her, and after that it was the work of an instant for the man to twist her arm painfully up behind her back, forcing her to drop the pepper spray. It clattered on the cobbles with a small, tinny, clicking noise that, to Evie, seemed somehow to signal the end of the world. Or of hers, anyway.
"Oh, God! No!"
shrieked Evie, now in a complete panic, with her last defence gone and pain shooting through all the joints of her arm, from shoulder through elbow to wrist.
"Please don't do this,"
she began to beg desperately, terror making her nauseous.
"I'll go home. I won't do it again, I swear. Please."
"What you think, fellas?"
asked the third finger man, forcing her arm farther behind her and bending her forward at the waist.
"Spare the rod. Spoil the child,"
Willie snickered evilly, leering suggestively to his mates and starting to unzip his pants fly with exaggerated theatrical emphasis. Only one rod in mind there, then. As the alley filled with coarse, masculine and thoroughly unpleasant laughter, with jokes about Willie getting his willy out and arguments about who got sloppy seconds, Evie felt her foot against the back of her calves, and she was forced down to her knees. Then, still twisting her arm, the finger man behind her grabbed her hair with his free hand and pulled her head up.
"Help!"
screamed Evie at the top of her voice, cold, hard cobblestones pressing painfully against her kneecaps.
"Please! Someone! Help me!"
She knew it was useless, of course. And so did the finger man. What made it somehow worse and more degrading was that it was all happening in this dank, filthy back alley, where she was being reduced to nothing more than another piece of garbage, like the garbage all around her. Something to be used and thrown away. Willie stepped toward her, belt undone now as well, and started to drop his pants. Suddenly, from somewhere in the nearby darkness beyond the light of the poster illuminating lamp, a voice rang out. A rich, declamatory, Shakespearean voice, aptly choosing its words for the situation revealed there before it in the alley, though the quotation quite passed by the major players in the scene.
"The multiplying villainies of nature do swarm upon him."
"What the hell?"
the third finger man shouted, looking up toward the pitch darkness farther down the alley. And then, from out of that inky blackness, something began to emerge a few feet above the ground. Something so bone-white it seemed to glow, that looked at first like a grinning skull suspended in the deep, oppressive night, but, as it slowly approached, transformed before their eyes into a slightly more human face, dead white except for the merest touches of colour on lip and cheeks, the blackness of an upturned moustache and goatee, the smile forever frozen. A mask. A forehead shaded by a wide-brim hat.
"We're finger men, pal!"
Tweedcoat yelled fiercely, though he was well enough aware that he was shouting in the dark, trying to drive off this unnerving spectre by the power of words alone.
"Bugger off!"
added Willie, eyes fixed on the mask, hands starting to drop toward the pants around his ankles, all thoughts of sexual gratification suddenly wilted in the face of sudden threat. It might be just a passing lunatic. God knew the world being the way it was, there were still enough of them about, in spite of the efforts to have them all locked up or shot. Or it might be real and present danger. Might be both. Whatever or whoever it was it needed dealing with right now, the girl could be left until later. But somehow a sudden rush of fear prevented his fingers from getting a proper grip on his clothing.
"Disdaining fortune with his brandished steel," the voice came once again, the mask now approaching more swiftly. "Which smoked with bloody execution."
A gap appearing suddenly in the cloud. A shaft of moonlight then shone down into the noisome alley, glinted on the damp and greasy granite cobblestones, the rusting garbage cans and tattered boxes, picked out the black-clad, swirl-cloaked figure that wore the mask, and flashed alarmingly from the lengthy steel blade he held so firmly in a dark-gloved hand.
"He's got a knife!"
shouted the third and biggest finger man, suddenly producing a heavy police baton from inside his coat. That cry at least freed Willie from his paralysis, but all he could do was trip and fall, the pants still tangled round his ankles. And before he could even get to his knees again, it was all over. Not quite sure what was happening, Evie could only watch the ensuing destruction in a state of terror that rapidly gave way to astonishment, not entirely sure how any human being could move so fast, unable, really, to see whether the newcomer was using fist or foot, punches or kicks, though there was no question at all about the long and deadly knife. Everything became a whirlwind blur of violence she could hardly see, and which she understood still less. With lightning speed, the masked man was there among his opponents, cloak streaming behind him, knife in one hand, the other bunched into a hammer-like fist. That fist seemed to Evie to catch the baton-wielding finger man in the gut with enormous power and sent him hurtling backward to crash against the wall, his head snapping back to crack loudly on the brick. The baton slipped from his fingers, he slid slowly down the wall and collapsed into an unconscious heap, perhaps even terminally unconscious. Somehow he seemed to be bleeding too, but she'd seen nothing of the cause. Could anyone wield a knife too quickly for the eye to see? By then, Tweedcoat had managed to pull out his pistol and cock it, but before the hammer could fall, a thrown knife flashed swiftly through the moonlight, took him in the shoulder, and sent him spinning away, reeling for balance as the gun discharged wildly. Before he could get off another shot, he, too, was lacking consciousness completely,
and the knife was snugly back there in the belt sheath from which, mere moments earlier, it had been drawn. Was he still alive? Evie had no idea at all. And that just left Willie still struggling with his pants in an animal panic and desperately trying to get to his feet. Not so he could fight, so he could run for his life. He had only just managed to get to his knees when a big black shadow loomed over him like the finally closing lid of a heavy funeral casket.
"Jesus Christ!"
yelled Willie, and if he had any inkling that he was kneeling there before his enemy in much the same position as Evie had done before him a few seconds previously, the irony was completely lost on him.
"Mercy! Please, mercy!"
"We are oft to blame in this," the masked and caped figure remarked contemplatively, and only then did Willie notice his companion's long and heavy baton was nestling in the man's black gloved hand, was slapping threateningly in the other palm. "'Tis too much proved that with devotion's visage and pious action we do sugar o'er the devil himself."
"What does that mean?"
whimpered Willie uncomprehendingly, looking up in wide-eyed terror at the expressionless mask above him. But no, as he looked again, he realized that the features weren't at all expressionless, unmoving as they were. As the moonlight improved a little more, the smile became more obvious, and plainly, for Willie, it was not a pleasant smile.
"Spare the rod," the newcomer patiently explained, and then the baton slapped down with a wet, sickening crunch. After that, Willie couldn't get up.
All this time, of course, Evie Hammond had sprawled there on the alley floor, watching without understanding anything of this at all, not knowing how or why someone had suddenly appeared and dealt with three hulking fingermen who were threatening her with a traditional fate worse than death, possibly to be followed by death itself, not knowing how he could have dealt with the brutes at all, let alone so swiftly and so violently that she'd hardly had time to take in what he'd done. She'd seen her share of violence, of course. Everyone had, in times like these. But nothing like that. And usually it had been handed out by the agents of the finger, not to them. Worse, she had no idea what the newcomer was intending to do next. As the masked man turned toward her, almost as if he were noticing her for the first time, she hurriedly scrambled across the cobbles, picked up the pepper spray that she'd been forced to drop earlier, and held it up defensively before her as she waited for him to make the next move. Even as she did so, she couldn't help thinking about how useless it had been to her earlier. Thought, in turn, that it would probably be even more useless now.
"I assure you that I mean you no harm," he said calmly, almost gently, with just the merest trace of a bow. And if there seemed to be a genuine concern for her in his voice, Evie still wasn't quite convinced.
Who are you?"
she asked nervously, pepper spray still raised, even though she knew, after what she'd just seen, that he could almost certainly take it away from her as easily as candy from a child.
"Who?" he queried, in an almost puzzled tone. "Who is but the form following the function of what? And what I am is a man in a mask."
"I can see that,"
Evie responded, though she still felt just as confused as ever. "Of course you can," he told her patiently. "I'm not questioning your powers of observation. I'm merely remarking upon the paradox of asking a masked man who he is."
"Oh," said Evie hesitantly. "Oh, right."
"But on this most auspicious of nights," he continued, now becoming increasingly grandiloquent, "permit me then, in lieu of the more commonplace sobriquet, to suggest the character of this dramatis persona."
A grand and extravagantly theatrical gesture followed, taking in somehow the whole of himself, from crown of hat to sole of booted foot, and at the same time also managing to separate out his black-clad form from the darkness of his surroundings.
"Voila!"
The slightest pause, perfectly timed for maximum effect, and then, "in view a humble vaudevillian veteran cast vicariously as both victim and villain by the vicissitudes of fate." Evie simply stared and forgot to hold the pepper spray quite as high as previously. And, as if taking her silence as willing agreement to his carrying on, he raised one hand to indicate his mask. "This visage, no mere veneer of vanity, is a vestige of the vox populi now vacant, vanished. A vital voice, once venerated, now vilified. However, this valorous visitation of a bygone vexation now stands vivified, and has vowed to vanquish these venal and virulent vermin vanguarding vice and vouchsafing the violent, vicious, and voracious violation of volition." He paused for effect, then, and Evie felt her jaw dropping. But perhaps that was the effect he was after. And anyway, before she could say anything, let alone ask him what the hell he was talking about, he was off again. "The only verdict is vengeance," he declared, "a vendetta, held as votive, not in vain, for the value and veracity of such shall one day vindicate the vigilant and virtuous. Yet verily this vichyssoise of verbiage veers most verbose, so let me simply add that it is my very great honour to meet you, and you may call me V." And with that he made a deep and grandiose bow, and extended a hand toward her, intent on helping her to her feet. She stared at the gloved hand before her, rather as if it might be dangerous, like a snake.
"Are you—" she began to murmur hesitantly. "Are you, like, a crazy person?"
"I'm quite sure they'll say so," he told her, proffering his hand more pointedly than before. "But to whom, might I ask, do I have the pleasure of speaking?"
"I'm—"
And still she couldn't help hesitating, though finally she dropped the pepper spray back into her pocket and reached out to take his hand.
"I'm Evie. Evie Hammond."
"Evie?" he remarked, with just a hint of puzzled surprise as he began to help her to her feet. "E-V."
"Yes, of course you are." "What does that mean?"
she asked, starting to dust herself down and straighten her clothes.
God, she looked such a mess.
But then that was hardly surprising after everything that had happened. "It means," a thoughtful tone now in his voice, "that I, like God, do not play with dice and do not believe in coincidence. Are you hurt?"
"No, I'm fine," she told him,
having finally checked herself out and feeling that she could now turn her attention to her rescuer. Not that she could tell much about him, cloaked, masked, and costumed as he was. Had he been on his way to some sort of fancy dress ball? Perhaps better not to ask.
"Thanks to you."
"I only played my part," he told her with another less formal but far more self-deprecating bow, and then, after a moment's contemplation, "But tell me, Evie, do you enjoy music?"
"I suppose so," she replied,
not entirely sure exactly what sort of music he had in mind. But the question brought back memories of her childhood. After all, there was so much more music then. Jazz, reggae, rock and roll, world music. All gone now, and nothing left to be heard except the approved music they played on the government-controlled radio stations, mostly militaristic crap. But why on earth should he ask her a question like that, when he'd just pulled her out of a hellhole situation like this? "You see, I'm a musician of sorts," explained the man who called himself V, "and on my way to give a very special performance."
"What kind of musician?" Evie asked,
suddenly nervous again and not entirely sure she really wanted to know the answer. "Percussion instruments are my speciality." Somehow the grin upon his mask seemed wider than before. "But tonight I intend to call upon the entire orchestra for this particular event. And—" again the briefest pause, the slightest bow— "I would be most honoured if you could join me."
"Oh, I don't think so,"
she said hurriedly, suddenly remembering all that had happened in the last few minutes, and being out after curfew as she was, could still happen all over again.
"I think I shall be getting home."
But while she stood there, flustered and uncertain, he stepped closer and took her hand, raising it toward his mask almost as if he were about to kiss it. She looked at him in astonishment, having only seen gestures like that in the historical TV shows, the ones set in the 19th century and earlier. the gestures of an old-fashioned English gentleman, a species she convinced herself had long ago ceased to exist. "I promise it will be like nothing you have ever heard or seen," he said, his voice insistent and magnetic, "and that afterwards you will return to your home quite safely." And somehow she knew that there was only one thing to say to such a politely phrased assurance.
"Well, all right."
After that, of course, the sense of adventure and excitement began to overwhelm Evie's nervousness. How often, after all, did she get the chance to be roaming through the empty streets of London at nearly midnight, accompanied only by a masked and mysterious man in black who could take out three of the feared and hulking fingermen in little more than the blink of an eye? And she felt she owed him something for that. So if he wanted to take her to some sort of musical performance, it would be less than gracious to tell him no. On the other hand, he wasn't exactly forthcoming about where this concert was going to be staged, or even precisely when. But as he led her along the streets, circling to avoid surveillance cameras and dodging occasionally into shadowed doorways or alley mouths when a passing patrol car cruised by, she began to think such questions mattered less and less, and gave herself over entirely to adventuring, or venturing, as Uyi would probably prefer to call it, alphabetically obsessive as he was. As if in response to her lightened mood, the breeze blew the cloud away, and the stars appeared, spattered like diamonds across the velvet cloak of night, and a brilliant silver moon sailed into view almost at the full, and shone its beams down on old London as it had for the last 2,000 years, without fear or favour for any of its inhabitants, regardless of their innocence or guilt. The nerves did come back, though, when, after a fairly circuitous route that roughly followed along New Oxford Street and then wove back and forth across and along High Holborn, they arrived at the Farringdon area, and instead of conducting her into some sort of concert hall, he led her up a fire escape and onto the roof of one of the taller buildings in the area. She was quite a long way from her Paddington flat now, too, despite his assurances that he'd see her safely home. But that feeling of nervousness was immediately overwhelmed then by the wonder of the view they could see all round them, silvered in the purest moonlight and sparkling beneath the stars. Ahead of them rose the Old Bailey, or, more properly, the Central Criminal Court, a massive pile of stone surmounted by a copper dome, which in turn supported the famous bronze statue of Justice. A blindfolded woman, with her arms extended straight out to either side, the scales of justice suspended from her left hand, the fearsome judicial sword rising from the right. A little to the right, the dome of Sir Christopher Wren's St. Paul's Cathedral, a phoenix rising up, resurgent from the devastation of the Great Fire, which had so thoroughly destroyed its predecessor. Farther south again, the monument commemorated the Great Fire itself, built in Pudding Lane where the flames had first begun. Beyond that, in turn, the rising skyscrapers of the City of London, the nation's financial heart, and farther on again, the even larger, block-like towers of Canary Wharf. Looking round, her gaze passed over the recently built, but familiar, Jordan television tower, familiar because she worked there, then turned back to the West End, to Centre Point, and the old post office tower, now headquarters of the Eye, before circling down to Westminster Abbey, and the Houses of Parliament, and farther south, the Thames. All laid out before her like a map, or some moonlit model of the way the city really ought to be, its crimes and vices, terrors and suppressions, hidden in the dark, its beauties highlighted by a heavenly radiance. No wonder someone—she thought it was Dr. Samuel Johnson long ago, but couldn't quite remember now— had said that he who's tired of London is tired of life. Or something like that, anyway. Her father had said it to her on a sightseeing expedition once, which meant she must have heard it a long time ago.
"It's beautiful up here," she said,
finally coming out of her absorption in the scene and turning round toward V, who stood beside her looking contemplatively toward the Old Bailey.
"A more perfect stage could not be asked for," he said softly, almost as if he too were enraptured by the setting.
"Still, I don't see any instruments," remarked Evie, puzzled.
Your powers of observation continue to serve you well. Now the smile that was fixed there on his mask seemed somehow to be a real smile, as if the more she got to know him, the more his voice and body language brought expression to the expressionless. But wait! And then, with the swiftness of a professional stage magician, V stepped toward the parapet and whipped out a slim conductor's baton from his sleeve, using it with a grand gesture to center her attention on the Old Bailey. "The Old Bailey," he began, "was built in 1907 on the site of the notorious Newgate Prison, a hellhole where you were lucky to survive long enough to be strung up. The famous highwayman Dick Turpin was once imprisoned there, among so many others awaiting their last day on Earth. A conclusion which for many must have come as a relief. Just across the road is the Magpie and Stumps, where execution breakfasts were served to the near hysterical crowds who gathered to watch the mass public hangings held not far from here, cheering wildly every time some poor wretch was taken off, until the executions were finally brought to a halt in 1868. And all that was back in the good old days, when England still had a judicial system and a functioning constitution, back long before the latest war, with everything that's happened since. The irony wasn't lost on Evie. Since the war, things had got far worse than that, and the Old Bailey had seen a countless number condemned to execution. It was just that nobody felt like cheering any more. Finally, returning to the subject of the evening's entertainment, he continued, "It is to Madam Justice that I dedicate this concerto, in honour of the holiday she seems to have taken from these parts, and in recognition of the impostor that stands there in her stead." Looking again at the statue, Evie couldn't help thinking how things had changed. Though both remained in Justice's hands, these days it was all sword and no scales. "Tell me," he asked, interrupting her contemplation, "do you know what night it is tonight, Evie?" She had to pause and think. "November the 5th?" And no sooner were the words out of her mouth than, back behind her, down at Westminster, Big Ben began to chime the midnight hour, the instant when this most significant night was at its deepest. And with a slight nod of the head, acknowledging the perfect timing of the bells, V continued, "And the meaning of the date?" She knew, of course, but also knew the date was no longer celebrated. After all, the official line was that Guy Fawkes had been nothing more than a terrorist attempting to overthrow the state. And even if, ever since, the populace had burned the traitor in effigy every year in eternal punishment for his crimes, it had all come to seem too much of a celebration for the current government. And anything remotely suggesting the celebration of terrorism had rigorously been stamped out. That was too much like free speech, and couldn't be allowed at all. Then, almost as if the distant tolling of the giant bell were occurring for no other reason than to accompany his voice, the masked man began to declaim, "Remember, remember, the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot." As the last note of the chiming midnight bell faded softly on the cooling air, V finally began his performance, tapping his baton on the stone parapet, and then raising both arms above his head, as if calling his unseen orchestra to attention. "First," he declared, "the overture." And then his arms began to move, slowly and gently at first, as if he were trying to coax music from silence. There was nothing to be heard, though, and Evie began to wonder if he really was crazy, and the music only existed in his head, or if all his performance would be nothing more than mime. Somehow what he was doing reminded her of an old Bugs Bunny cartoon she'd seen as a child, before everything American was banned. "Listen carefully," he said then, his soft voice reclaiming her attention. "Do you hear it?" Puzzled now, for there was obviously more to this than first appeared, Evie tilted her head and listened, while all the time she kept watching V's baton,
moving, summoning. "I hear it," she said suddenly, a childlike wonder in her voice. This, after all, was magic, and perhaps it was less a conductor's baton he held than a conjurer's wand. Although, even then, she wasn't quite sure whether she might just be imagining it after all. But no, it was definitely there. The soft strings of the opening bars of Peter Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture, rising slowly like a thin white mist emerging from the darkness of the London streets and alleys. As the music swelled up louder and picked up its well-known theme, she couldn't help dashing forward to the parapet and looking down, trying to locate its source. Finally, she thought she'd tracked it down to a nearby loudspeaker, one of the myriad now strung across London and all the other cities of the country that filled the days with announcements and propaganda and control orders. But no, it wasn't just one speaker. It was all of them. Right across London, Tchaikovsky's musical portrait of Moscow's heroic resistance to the invading Napoleonic hordes sang out, growing louder all the time, and interwoven with the theme, although the composer had intended them to represent nothing more nor less than the enemy, were extracts from the Marseillaise, that paean to the now-forgotten values of liberty, equality, and fraternity. That revolutionary call to arms, aux armes, mes enfants. And across the city, children woke and, startled, asked their mothers what it meant, while people spilled out into the moonlit streets to listen, curfew quite forgotten. For this was loud enough now to wake the entire city, loud enough perhaps to wake the dead, for were not most of the city's population now dead indeed to so many things that mattered? Liberty, equality, fraternity. And in the offices of the security services and police, and even there in Downing Street, all hell was breaking loose.
"How did you do that?"
Evie asked, a smile of astonishment all across her face.
"Wait," said V, still conducting, his gestures growing more frenzied and extravagant still. "Here comes the crescendo!"
Now the theme returned, far more powerful than at its first appearance, swelling inexorably toward its climax with all the battle fury of drums and cymbals and timpani, to the point where, upon its premiere, Tchaikovsky had had real cannon fired as part of the performance. And when that point was reached, the night sky over London was suddenly rent by a shattering explosion perfectly timed with the music, and the statue of blindfolded justice was simply blown apart in shards of melting metal, her sword and scales vanishing in a ball of angry smoke and flame. Evie could only stare in shock as the music rose again, and, once more timed to match the original cannon fire, a further series of thunderous explosions smashed the Old Bailey into myriad fragments.
"Beautiful, is it not?"
asked V, as the monstrous echoes of the collapsing building faded, and he turned to take a conductor's bow before his utterly startled audience. Evie just couldn't believe what she was seeing. That massive pile of stone and metal, one of the landmarks that had defined the face of London for a century or more, with all its history, all the memories of its criminal trials, for the most part just ones, though recent others rather less so, was simply gone. Shattered, crumpled, and all but obscured in billowing clouds of smoke and dust. And V had provided a ringside seat at the spectacle, just for her. But still the performance wasn't quite over, for as the roaring in her ears subsided, she suddenly heard the whoosh of fireworks and another far less voluminous explosion. But this was not the usual starburst of an exploding rocket. Rather, it was the performer's credit, writ large across the starry sky. Up there, in a pattern of bursting light, a single sparkling letter. V. Eyes wide with awe and surprise, Evie turned toward the perpetrator of the evening's entertainment. But he had already disappeared.
"V?"
she asked an empty rooftop. Asked again the empty, silent air.
"V?"
Then, all around, from those same speakers that mere moments before had provided the musical accompaniment, the harsh, discordant sirens began to wail.
3. The tension in the room was like the thick, black smoke of a sacrifice to evil gods. But none of the men gathered round the large table at its centre could bring himself to say anything to relieve it. This, too, was a room of gloom and shadows. But quite unlike that which lay hidden underground an unknown distance away, this contained nothing to lighten the oppressive air. No posters, books, or music. Certainly no bust of Shakespeare. For this was the new, modernized and thoroughly up-to-date cabinet room in Downing Street, now decorated in a totalitarian palette of grey, steel, and black. And here, where once elected cabinet ministers gathered to debate and discuss the country's fortunes and direction, sat the appointed department heads that these days represented the new body politic. Or rather its repression, for political life, like Guy Fawkes himself 400 years before, had now been hung, drawn and quartered, and afterward thrown to the dogs. These were hard-faced, ruthless men for the most part, who, despite their power, still couldn't quite avoid the caricaturing humour of the British public they did so much to stifle and suppress. And so these remnant travesties of supposedly legitimate government departments had their nicknames. The security services, the finger, visual surveillance, the eye, audio surveillance, the ear, criminal detection, the nose, propaganda, the mouth. All collectively known as the head, despite the apparent anomaly of including the finger among them. But then the finger was the most feared of all, and no one wanted to feel that particular digit's tap upon his shoulder. And here they all were, gathered round that large central table, haggard with lack of sleep, their faces lit only by small reading lamps upon the tabletop, and the concrete-coloured glow of a large monitor at the table's end. Waiting, like the monitor, for someone to appear. For the head, in fact, of the head itself. At last the monitor blinked into life, and then, as smokes were hurriedly stubbed and backs were suddenly straightened, the face of High Chancellor Adam Sutler glowered into view. And Chancellor Sutler was not at all a happy man.
"Gentlemen," he began coldly, "you've had 4 hours. You'd better have results."
An uncomfortable shuffling, for they all knew that the multiple cameras in the room would be returning their images to Sutler, just as his was reaching them. Who was going to get it first?
"Mr. Creedy!"
Peter Creedy leaned forward out of the darkness, the lamp illuminating a face of stone, the eyes displaying all the emotion of a gun barrel. A hard bastard, harder even than the men who served him. "The Old Bailey area is quarantined," the head of the finger said coolly. "All significant witnesses have been detained." And he might have added, were currently having whatever information they might possess beaten out of them at that very moment, but Sutler would know that anyway. The finger wasn't renowned for subtlety, just for efficiency of a peculiarly unpleasant kind, which was why there were some who referred to fingermen as the Gestapo, but never aloud. And never to their faces.
"Good,"
Sutler nodded.
"Mr. Etheridge."
The small man with large ears that seemed so naturally to match his position rather nervously began to speak.
"A recording device was found wired into the central emergency broadcast system. The DCD was Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture."
"Add it to the blacklist," cut in Sutler decisively. "I don't ever want to hear that music again."
"Yes, sir,"
Brian Etheridge replied, hurriedly making a note on a pad before him, seeming rather flustered as he felt the eyes of all the others present turn upon him. No wonder the man's nickname was Bunny, Sutler thought contemptuously. A rabbit caught in the headlights. If it wasn't for the man's obvious technical ability, he'd have been replaced long ago. Just the sort of man that Sutler no longer wished to have to mix with at all, in fact. Although when it came right down to it, the High Chancellor didn't want to have to deal personally with any of them, let alone the hoi polloi out on the streets. Thus the video link, rather than personal contact with his own cabinet. Human beings couldn't be trusted to behave themselves in any logical fashion, no matter how strictly you kept them under control. Not like the computers, whose company he'd come to prefer more and more over the years to human interaction.
Machines at least obeyed physical, scientific laws that were forever immutable. Human beings, no matter how rigidly you enforced the most logical of man-made laws, continued to break them. Well, if anyone broke his laws, like this terrorist who'd committed last night's outrage, he'd break them, as surely as God had given him the power to. And the right.
"We've also doubled our random sweeps,"
Etheridge gulped next, hating to ever have to report anything remotely like news his leader wouldn't want to hear.
"And are monitoring an increased amount of phone surveillance, indicating a high percentage of conversation concerned with the explosion."
"Mr. Dascombe, what are we doing about that?"
Sutler asked, razor-sharp as ever. From long experience, no one gathered here in the cabinet room ever let his attention slip for an instant. Others in the past who hadn't stayed on their toes just hadn't stayed in their jobs. Roger Dascombe, however, was not one of those likely to be on their way out any time soon. Sleek, tanned, and immaculately dressed in a bespoke suit, without the slightest wrinkle, he looked every bit as perfect as he obviously thought he was. In fact, right now he looked rather peeved that anyone, even the Chancellor, should think it worth asking him what he was going to do about a situation he'd had fully under control within an hour of the explosions. The mouth didn't just hang around with its jaw dropping open after all.
"We're calling it an emergency demolition," he explained,
unable to avoid a smug glance round at his companions.
"We have spin coverage on the network and throughout the interlink. Several experts have been lined up to testify about the Old Bailey's lack of structural integrity."
On the monitor screen, Sutler nodded, paused for just an instant's thought, then added,
"I want Protheroe to speak tonight on the dangers of these old buildings and how we must avoid clinging to the edifice of a decadent past. He should conclude by saying that the new Bailey will become a symbol of our time, and of the future that our conviction has rewarded us with."
Then, almost as if he were searching for his next victim in the dark, Sutler leaned closer to the camera and pronounced,
"Mr. Hare!"
Conrad Hare was difficult to even notice, hanging back as he did in the shadows. Not so much a man of mystery as one who thought the best way to stay out of trouble was not to be noticed, unless it was really necessary. Quiet efficiency was the image he wanted to project.
"Our surveillance cameras captured several images of the terrorist," announced the head of the Eye, "though the mask obviously makes retinal identification impossible. We also managed to get a picture of the girl that Creeder's men were, detaining."
"Who is she, Mr. Finch?"
Not sure yet, sir, but we're working on several leads."
Eric Finch was a long-time career policeman who really had no time for all this nose stuff and preferred to just think of himself as still holding his old rank of chief inspector, before they'd bumped him up, not entirely willingly, to department head. Chief Constable would have been a more appropriate title for the rank he held now, but they'd shot the last Chief Constable of London when he'd tried to revolt against the party takeover, and abolished the title thereafter. Shot him in public, too, to make an example of the traitor. Almost 60 now, lined and worn, Finch had that sagging, world-weary look of a professional bloodhound. And frankly, he couldn't wait to be out of the place. Police work and detection were the things that interested him, not politicking and hanging round in cabinet offices.
"Anything else?" Sutler asked him.
"We located the fireworks launcher and found traces of the explosives used at the site. Unfortunately, it appears that, despite the heavy level of sophistication, these devices were homemade with over-the-counter chemicals, making them very difficult to trace. Whoever he is, Chancellor, he's very good."
"Save your professional annotations, Mr. Finch," said Sutler coldly, uninterested in praise for fallible human beings. "They're irrelevant."
Finch bit back an oath and filed away several expletive-laden thoughts for later conversation about the iron-hearted, inhuman bastard he had to answer to. Then said what he knew he had to say.
"Apologies, Chancellor."
On the screen, Sutler could be seen sitting back in his chair, obviously satisfied that by now he'd heard all the relevant reports. After a moment's thought, he leaned forward toward the camera once more.
"Gentlemen, this is a test," he said in his best politically lecturing, religiously sermonizing voice. "Moments such as these are matters of faith. To fail is to invite doubt in everything we believe and in everything we have fought for. Doubt will plunge this country back into chaos, and I will not let that happen. I want this terrorist found, gentlemen, and I want him to learn what terror really means."
And then, as always, the Chancellor's concluding words.
"England prevails!"
And with varying degrees of enthusiasm and belief, those around the table chorused back the same response.
"England prevails!"
And indeed, England prevailed nowhere more so than at the Jordan Television Tower, the veritable mouthpiece of the government's information service, and one that Roger Dascombe regarded very much as his own private domain. Sitting there in the control booth an hour after his return from Downing Street, he couldn't help but experience a feeling of smug satisfaction. All the other head men, such as Finch and Creedy, were jumping through hoops right now, and here he was, with everything perfectly under control. An operation so slick it could just slide through any crisis and still come out sparkling on the other side. And there in the studio before him, sitting casually on a sofa just close enough to suggest a certain intimacy, and raise that age-old question in the viewer's mind, were they at it when the cameras disappeared or not, were the immaculately dressed Dick and June, the nation's darlings, selling the morning news wholesale to a captive audience. No surnames, no accents, no previous convictions, no whiff of scandalous behaviour, and not a single hint of personality. They were absolute perfection, young, gorgeous, and, as everyone just knew, completely trustworthy. And no, they weren't at it. Off-screen they hated each other's guts like fury, refused even to have their dressing rooms on the same floor. And the viewers never knew. True professionals, the pair of them. A glance at the auto cue, and then Dick grinned with effortless plasticity and with perfect enunciation, delivered Dascombe's perfect lines. "On the lighter side of things, it seems that the crew responsible for the demolition of the Old Bailey wanted to give the old girl a grand, albeit improvised, send-off." Back in the control booth, Dascombe's senior assistant, Patricia, no surnames behind the camera either, everyone was part of Roger's family here, except perhaps for Gordon Dietrich, glanced away from the monitors and whispered to him, just a little nervously,
"You think people will buy this?"
"Why not?" Dascombe smirked. "This is the British Television Network, and BTN's job is to report the news, not fabricate it."
"That's the government's job."
Back out on the sofa, June had picked up Dick's line with effortless ease and now continued.
"Though the demolition had been planned for some time, the music and the fireworks were, according to the crew chief, definitely not on the schedule."
Then, with perfect simultaneity, the perfectly pitched chuckle from the duo. "All is well with the world," it said.
"It was just a tiny joke by an over-enthusiastic crew member that got a little out of hand. Trust us."
And after a few seconds for the message to sink in, there was Dick. "We'll be right back."
"Do you believe that bloody load of bullocks?"
asked Evie's friend Vicky as they sat together in the room where they worked, farther down the corridor on the same floor of Jordan Tower, a pair of young PAs intent on working their way a lot higher up. And if there was an odd little smile round Evie's lips as she sifted through the schedules and the mass of daily paperwork, then Vicky was too busy looking up at the monitor in the corner of the room to notice.
"There was no bleeding demolition,"
Vicky continued, betraying her East End roots with every word she spoke. At times Evie half expected her to break into Cockney rhyming slang and refer to "going up the apples and pears," or "talking of the old dog and bone." But somehow it never went beyond a litter of swear words and working-class crudities. Though to give Vicky her due, she was trying her best to improve.
"I saw it," added Vicky. "The whole thing. Everyone in my flat did. Did you see it?"
"No,"
said Evie, suddenly just the slightest touch nervous. She didn't need anyone asking her about the previous evening, even Vicky. But something had to be said.
"Last night I—"
"Oh, that's right,"
pounced Vicky gleefully, blue eyes sparkling.
"You went to Daddy Dietrich's last night, didn't you? Come on, spill, spill."
Fortunately, before Evie could even think about what to say, the door swung open and there was Patricia, bustling into the room, not exactly angry, but not exactly pleased.
"Evie, there you are,"
she began immediately, businesslike as ever.
"You are still working for me, aren't you?"
A moment's confusion, and then Evie noticed the small personal radio she used as an intercom between floors sitting on her desk.
Somehow, after the night's excitements, she'd managed to forget to switch it on this morning.
"Sorry, Patricia," she said contritely.
That apology seemed to be enough, and Patricia was never one to waste time on useless chatter. Now that she'd found her missing minion, the task list just spilled from her lips in no time at all.
"Any 2 espressos and 3 filter coffees from downstairs, and Dietrich is ready for his tea."
She turned to go, already intent on the next item on the day's agenda.
"And we'd like them just a little sooner than yesterday, please."
And Vicky, suddenly seeming enormously busy, glanced up and smiled briefly as Evie leapt to her feet, blushing, and dashed away through the door in Patricia's wake. This book is continued on Disc 2.